On September 22nd, 2004, my husband and I gathered around our television and watched alongside 18.6 million other people as Oceanic Flight 815 lost control, veered off course, and crashed upon an uncharted island somewhere between Sydney, Australia, and Los Angeles, California. From the end of that very first episode of Lost, we were hooked. And to prove it, we dedicated 1 hour of every Thursday night for the next 6 years of our lives watching the fate of the survivors of that crash unfold. Lost is often cited by critics as being one of the best TV shows of all time, and yet its series finale is often ranked as being among the worst of all time. And there are few things in this life that disappoint as much as a really bad ending. I couldn't help but think of that very last episode of Lost as I finished up my reading of Judges this week. Just as us dedicated viewers of Lost were left sad and confused by the show's ending, us dedicated studiers of Judges were likely left sad and confused by its end as well. But my hope today, as we walk through these final chapters of Judges together, is that we would come to an understanding of how this is so much more than just a really bad ending. And to do that, we're going to discuss why exactly these chapters are here and what the Lord hopes to teach us through them. So let's get started. This week's section of scripture begins with a phrase that is already familiar to us. In those days when there was no king in Israel. So we encountered that phrase twice in last week's section of scripture, and here it is again. And this phrase is gonna be very important for our understanding of this material, and it's gonna do several things for us. First, it's going to serve as a reminder of when we are in the history of Israel. So 9 weeks ago, when we first entered into our study of Judges, I told you that the period of the Judges was a time between authoritative certainties in the history of Israel. So we had Joshua and Moses marked as very clear, consistent, and godly leaders right before the period of the Judges began. And then we're actually going to have the establishment of the monarchy, which is going to serve as the end of the period of the Judges. But when we think about when we are, we also want to keep in mind what Christy flagged for us last week as we entered into our study of chapter 17. So the last five chapters of Judges actually serve as the book's epilogue. So that means that when we are thinking about when we are, we want to keep in mind that these chapters appear at the end of the book, not because they belong there chronologically, but because the author is using the stories in these last five chapters to serve as a comment on everything that has happened previously in the book of Judges. So as we think about when we are, we want to keep in mind that we are actually near the beginning of the time of the Judges. And for those of you that are curious, we know this because of the mention of Phinehas, the high priest at the time, who was the grandson of Aaron. And that reference is in 20:28. And I'm going to tell you why it's so important that we keep when we are in the history of Israel in mind, because this tells us that the horrific events that we read about in this section of scripture is not the end result of hundreds of years of the Israelites abandoning the Lord. As much as we are going to want to believe that to be the truth, the hard reality is that it did not take Israel generations upon generations to descend to the depths of depravity that we see in this week's reading. One generation knew the Lord, the next generation did not, and it happened as quickly as that. In those days, there was no king in Israel. So in addition to cluing us in regarding when we are in the history of Israel, that phrase also serves as an explanation of how things were and why. In short, because there was no consistent, clear, and godly leader in Israel, the nation began to deteriorate from the inside out. Everyone did whatever seemed right to them. So God's law was no longer their standard for living, but everybody set the standard for themselves. And it should come as no surprise that that leads to a very bad ending. Last week, we saw how this had resulted in a people who had a very confused relationship with God. And this week, we're going to see, as an extension of that, a people who have a very confused relationship with each other. And it should come to no surprise to us that that one thing necessarily comes from the other. So we're going to begin reading in Judges 19:1. In those days, when there was no king in Israel, a Levite staying in a remote part of the hill country of Ephraim acquired a woman from Bethlehem in Judah as his concubine. So chapter 19 begins by introducing us to the characters who are at the center of this week's drama, a Levite and his concubine. Now, if you were wondering, this is a completely different Levite from last week's Levite, which you think would be a good thing, but it actually is not a good thing at all. So if you've spent time in the narrative of the Old Testament, that term concubine is a term that you more than likely have encountered before. A concubine was a woman who lived with a man as a wife of secondary status. Now, the mention of the Levite's concubine here at the beginning of chapter 19 provides us with a really good reason to stop and remember that just because something is spoken of in Scripture, that does not necessarily imply the Lord's approval of that thing. Nod your head. I need you to hear that. Just because something is spoken of in Scripture does not imply the Lord's approval of that thing. There are so many instances in Scripture when we are told of an event or of a state of affairs, and Scripture is silent on the fact of if God approves of that thing or disapproves of that thing. And I'm going to tell you that is a very good reason for us to make sure that we are familiar with the whole story of Scripture, that we are familiar with the commands of God, with the laws of God, so that when Scripture is silent regarding whether God approves or disapproves of a thing, we know enough of his nature and his character and his word to draw appropriate conclusions. And sometimes it's going to be fairly easy for us to do that, and sometimes it's going to be a bit more difficult, and we're going to have to wrestle more, but that's okay. It's a part of how God has designed us to interact with him, but it's going to be very important that we remember these things and take those opportunities to speak with and wrestle with the Lord as we work through today's section of Scripture. So picking up in 19:2, but the concubine was unfaithful to him and left him for her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah. She was there for 4 months. So there's disagreement among scholars regarding what the reference to the concubine's unfaithfulness actually means here. Some say that it means she was sexually unfaithful. Others contend that given the context and of what happens, it seems more likely that the two had an argument and that they fought and then she left, which also would have constituted unfaithfulness according to the view of the day. So whatever the reason for her departure, after 4 months, the man decides to pursue her return, so he traveled to her father's house in order to retrieve her. And the woman's father warmly welcomes him and his servant into the home. They are so warmly welcomed, in fact, that the host insists that they stay for 5 days. It reminds me of when I used to try to go leave my grandma's house. Just couldn't get out the door. So this scene is important, although it probably seemed to drag on a little bit for you, but it's important because it provides us with a picture of what hospitality was supposed to look like in the ancient world. But finally, on the 5th day, the Levite insists that they really have to be going now, so the group sets out late in the afternoon, the Levite, his concubine, and his servant. 19:11. When they were near Jabus and the day was almost gone, the servant said to his master, "Please, why not let us stop at this Jebusite city and spend the night there?" But his master replied to him, "We will not stop at a foreign city where there are no Israelites." So a discerning reader might have picked up on the fact that the servant had a bit of a nervous tone there. Night was quickly falling, and if you remember, not even daytime travel was always safe during the period of the judges. So the servant proposes that they stop at the nearest opportunity, but the Levite insisted that they push ahead even further in order to reach the sure safety of a city of fellow Israelites. 19:14. So they continued on their journey, and the sun set as they neared Gibeah and Benjamin. They stopped to go in and spend the night in Gibeah. The Levite went in and sat down in the city square, but no one took them into their house to spend the night. The last part of that statement may not have immediately stood out to those of us reading this here now, but it definitely would have immediately stood out to the original readers of this account. Hospitality was one of the sacred laws of the ancient world. A traveler who did not have a place to stay would make their way to the city square, and then a local would take notice of them and extend an invitation for them to take shelter at their home for the night. This is how travelers were cared for in the days before Holiday Inns. So the lack of hospitality here in this Benjaminite city stands in very stark contrast to the extreme hospitality that we saw just a few verses back with the concubine's father. And here, I want you to notice that the writer of this account is dropping a hint. Something is not quite right in the town of Gibeah. So fortunately, an old man returning from a day of work notices the travelers, and he does what every other person, frankly, should have done by that point. He extends to them an invitation for them to lodge with him for the evening, and he warns the Israelite, do not stay in the town square. There's another hint. Something is very wrong in Gibeah. From this point forward, the story in Judges 19 bears a striking resemblance to one of the most infamous stories in the book of Genesis, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Upon even the briefest inspection, it's impossible for the reader of Judges 19 to miss its connection to the story contained in Genesis 19. In both accounts, the wicked men of the city wished to rape the outsider, the guest of an outsider who was sojourning in the city. And likewise, in both accounts, the host offered to the evil men their daughter in place of their guest. Now, there are some differences in these two accounts that I want to attend to as well. And the first difference, and this just stood out to me so starkly, is that the Lord intervened in the Genesis account. The angel rescued Lot and his daughters from the evil men of the city, and then the Lord brought total destruction upon the city of Sodom and Gomorrah and all of their inhabitants. And we simply just do not see that type of intervention here. And I kept coming back to why. Why not God? And although I can't tell you with absolute certainty, because Scripture does not give us a reasoning for the Lord's actions here, it did occur to me finally, after sitting with this for quite a long time, that the absence of the Lord in Judges 19, which is marked, especially when we see what happens in the Genesis 19 account, the marked absence of the Lord in the Judges 19 story, it seems to flow quite along with the absence that we've already noticed in chapter 17 and 18 of Judges. So when we consider the flow of the epilogue as a whole, we see that this was a day when everybody was doing whatever seemed right to him. The people of God were not seeking God. And it just seemed to speak really clearly to me that the absence of God in this account serves to punctuate that for us. So the second difference that we absolutely have to notice is that in the Genesis account, the guilty men were Canaanites. In the Judges account, the guilty men are Israelites. The evil once resided outside of God's people, and now the evil resided inside of God's people. So the author's point is very loud and clear. He is telling the Israelites, we have become just like them. When God's people do not strive to know and live by God's standards, we have every capacity to become just like the very worst of humanity. Now, I'm not going to belabor the nature of the crimes committed against the Levite's concubine. I trust you all read the account. You are sufficiently familiar with the details. But I do want to say that if the text of Scripture shocks us, it is because it is intended to. The woman endures a horrifying night of abuse, and then she crawls back to the threshold of the door where the Levite finds her, unresponsive the next morning. Eager to get home very quickly and safely, he callously loads her on the back of his donkey, either already dead or very near so, and he hightails it out of there. And then what happens next is even more shocking than what we have already read. 1929, when he entered his house, he picked up a knife, took hold of his concubine, cut her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and then sent her throughout the territory of Israel. I found the Levites' response to the crime to be every bit as revolting as the crime itself. And it really just has to be said that this was not the only way in which he could have dealt with the situation. If the Levite had gone to Shiloh, where God's tabernacle was, and if he had consulted with the high priest, then everything could have been dealt with in accordance with the law of God, even minus the dismembered body. I mean, God's law is not naive. It was not ill-equipped to deal with the depravity of man, and there were provisions in it even to deal with this mess. Those guilty of the crime against the woman would have been put to death, but what I want you to see is that the Levites' extreme action here resulted in inflaming the tempers of Israel, and then once lit, much like the fire of Abimelech, things quickly spread out of control. 1930. Everyone who saw it said, nothing like this has ever happened or has been seen since the day the Israelites came out of the land of Egypt until now. Think it over, discuss it, speak up. All the Israelites from Dan to Beersheba and from the land of Gilead came out, and the community assembled as one body before the Lord at Mitzpah. The leaders of all the peoples and of all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of God's people, 400,000 armed foot soldiers. Assuming that the Levite's extreme action was taken in order to get the attention of Israel, we can see that that certainly worked. Representatives from all over Israel came out. They assembled as one body before the Lord in Mitzpah, with just a few very notable exceptions. So first, the text informs us that the tribe of Benjamin heard about the meeting, but for some reason, nobody made a showing. And then second, and this is going to become very important later, the people from a little place called Jabesh Gilead also failed to send a representative. So despite those few who did not RSVP, we see remarkable unity among the Israelites here, and that's another very big contrast for us in these closing chapters of Judges. Right? Several times in our study and in our reading of the book of Judges, we've seen how the tribes of Israel failed to unite against their foreign enemies. But here, at the end of the book of Judges, the author is emphasizing how they had remarkable unity against their brothers. They implore the Levite to tell them exactly how the events transpired. It's probably very safe to assume that none of us in this room are very big fans of the Levite at this point. So just as we might expect, when he retells of the events of the evening, he happens to leave out every single detail that points to his own culpability. No mention of how he was the one who threw his concubine out to the men in order to save his own skin. No mention of how he left her outside all night. No mention of how he actually managed to get some sleep that night as she suffered unspeakable horrors. And no mention of how he was prepared to hightail it out of there without her, had he not literally tripped over her body on the way out. If there was any question in your mind regarding the nature of the relationship between the Levite and his concubine, when chapter 19 opened, I trust that question has been settled now. She was nothing more than a piece of property to him. In fact, I found it very difficult to even take his outrage seriously. Nonetheless, the Israelites are rightly horrified by what had transpired, and they decide to take immediate action against the city of Gibeah. So they rallied the troops and they gathered united against the city. 2012. Then the tribes of Israel sent men throughout the tribe of Benjamin, saying, "What is this evil act that has happened among you? Hand over the wicked men in Gibeah so we can put them to death and purge evil from Israel." But the Benjaminites would not listen to their fellow Israelites. Instead, the Benjaminites gathered together from their cities to Gibeah to go out and fight against the Israelites. So what is going on here with the Benjaminites' response? Why would they go against their fellow Israelites in order to protect the people who had perpetrated such a horrific crime? Well, I don't think if they had been thinking clearly, they would have come to this decision. I mean, Israel had 400,000 foot soldiers. Benjamin only had 26,000. I mean, those are just simply not good odds. And as I think, when we think through the Benjaminites' response here, it could be that the instinct for them to protect their own flared up in response to the Israelites' exaggerated response, which was triggered by the Levites' extreme action. I mean, think about it if you're in Benjamin's shoes. Israel had already gathered troops, and a lot of them. Israel had already made plans to attack the entire city of Gibeah, not just the people who perpetrated the crime. Benjamin knew something was going on, so you imagine that their defenses were already pretty high. And under these extenuating circumstances, we often have a very strong impulse to gather up and protect our own people. Have you ever experienced that with your own friends or your family members? If somebody's come against somebody that you love, I have certainly stood up for my people, even when I knew they were wrong, when someone was coming very fiercely against them. So maybe that's what was going on with Benjamin. Here's another thing I want you to see about Israel's response. Israel was so riled up by the Levites' grand showing that they made not one, but two very rash oaths when they gathered together at mitzvah. First, they swore that they would not give any of their daughters in marriage to the men of Benjamin. And then second, they decided that they would just kill everyone who didn't show up for the meeting at mitzvah. Now, these oaths were not only extreme, but they were altogether unnecessary. My point here in looking at Israel's response is that Israel had already made up their mind. They had reached a verdict before a trial could even be conducted, and that was simply not in line with the wisdom that the Lord had given them. God's law had made it clear that before someone was sentenced to death, their guilt had to be established by more than one witness. So Israel should have questioned those involved, they should have weighed the evidence, and then they should have carried out the prescribed punishment as God had instructed. So please hear me. Israel's horror at the act was justified, but their response only succeeded in making matters worse. Israel had made it very, very difficult for the tribe of Benjamin to actually do the correct thing. And I think that that is an important place of application for us. When we are on the receiving end of a clear wrong, it is very easy for us to become self-righteous instead of responding in humility. It is very easy to then make accusations instead of asking questions. And when we do that, it actually makes it difficult for the person who has offended us to respond in a godly way. Israel had made it very difficult for Benjamin to back off and respond rightly, and that by this point, the battle line had been drawn and there was going to be a fight. 2017, the Israelites, apart from Benjamin, mobilized 400,000 armed men, everyone an experienced warrior. They set out, went to Bethel, and inquired of God. The Israelites asked, "Who is going to fight first against the Benjaminites?" And the Lord answered, "Judah will be first." So here we see something that we have not seen so far in the epilogue of Judges. The Israelites go to the Lord, and I want you to notice that when they inquire of him, the Lord finally re-enters the narrative. Now, despite the fact that the Israelites had gone about this all wrong, the Benjaminites' wrong was even more wrong than their wrong. And I think that the Lord's response to the Israelites here demonstrates this. The Benjaminites were no longer simply rebelling against their fellow Israelites. They were now rebelling against the Lord. Now, we cannot miss the similarities between Israel's request of the Lord here and in a request that they made of the Lord earlier in the book of Judges. So in Judges 1:1, the opening of the entire book, the Israelites came to the Lord unified against the Canaanites, inquiring who should go first into the fight. And then here in Judges 20, the Israelites come to the Lord again, unified against their brothers, the Benjaminites, asking who should go first into battle. And in both instances, the Lord responds with Judah. That is the tribe who should go in first to fight. So the similarities in those two accounts, one at the very beginning of Judges and one here at the very end, they're intended to catch our eye. Again, it's another very stark contrast that the writer of the account is presenting us with, right? It's supposed to highlight for us just how confused this whole situation had become. Now, I want you to notice a very important difference between these two accounts. In chapter one, the Lord assured the Israelites victory, but here in chapter 20, he does not. God tells them to go into battle. He tells the Israelites to fight against the Benjaminites, but he does not tell them that they will win. He doesn't offer any promise that he fails to keep. And I think that goes a long way in helping us understand what happens next. Because what we see is that the Benjaminites actually prevailed in the first two battles. They killed 22,000 and then 18,000 Israelites in those respective battles. And then with each loss, Israel grows increasingly humbled, and their response to the Lord grows increasingly contrite. After that first loss, they wept before the Lord. After the second loss, we see that they wept. They sat before the Lord. They fasted. They made offerings. They asked, should we again fight against our brothers, the Benjaminites, or should we stop? And the Lord answered, fight. I will hand them over to you tomorrow. So the Benjaminites' earlier victories had infused them with confidence, and this actually is the thing that set the stage for their defeat. 20:35, the Lord defeated Benjamin in the presence of Israel, and on that day, the Israelites slaughtered 25,100 men of Benjamin, all of them armed. Then the Benjaminites realized that they had been defeated. So it's very important that you see this. At that point, the Israelites had won. God had given them the victory just as he has promised, and the entire thing should have been over. But then Israel goes on and proceeds to lay waste to every other Benjaminite city. Benjaminite women, gone. Benjaminite children, gone. Benjaminite men, almost gone. 600 of the warriors actually managed to escape to a stronghold, which means that the only people from Benjamin who survived were those who rightly should have been put to death. This was so far beyond what the Lord had authorized them to do, and Israel realized too late that they had gone entirely too far, but that didn't stop them from continuing to do exactly what seemed right to them. With only 600 Benjaminite men left and zero Benjaminite women left and a very firm understanding of how Benjaminite babies needed to be made, Israel realized that they had a problem. They needed 600 brides for these Benjaminites and stat because they had almost annihilated an entire tribe of Israel. But instead of rightly attributing that tragedy to themselves, they wrongly attribute it to God. 21:15 tells us the people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord had made this gap in the tribes of Israel. If only they hadn't made that foolish oath when they showed up at Mitzvah. You know, the one where they promised where they would not give any of their daughters in marriage to the Benjaminites. But then somebody remembers that second foolish oath that they made at Mitzvah when they swore that they would kill anyone who didn't show up for the meeting. So the Israelites contrived a way to use the second very foolish oath as a means of solving the problem that was in part created by their first very foolish oath. And the so-called solution to this problem results in the kidnapping Well, first, it results in the absolute slaughter of an entire other city of Israelites, and then also in the kidnapping and what would certainly be considered in our day today rape of 600 young Israelite women. I mean, the irony and the hypocrisy of this cannot be missed by us. In chapter 19 of Judges, the Israelites of Gibeah were presented as on par with the Canaanite citizens of Sodom and Gomorrah. And then here in chapter 21, the entire rest of Israel is presented as being as on par with another Canaanite who we met earlier in Judges, Sisera, the serpent of Judges 4 and 5, who was known for kidnapping and raping the women whose territory he conquered. How very confused. After kidnapping their wives in Shiloh, 21:23, the Benjaminites went back to their own inheritance, rebuilt their cities, and lived in them. At that time, each of the Israelites returned from there to his own tribe and family. Each returned from there to his own inheritance. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did whatever seemed right to him. This week's text of scripture ends in the same place it began. In those days, there was no king in Israel. So that statement serves as a bookend to this very confused section of scripture. It was meant to serve as an explanation to the reader regarding how things could have gone so terribly wrong. Because the people had no king, everybody enthroned themselves as king, and they ruled and they reigned over their own lives, everyone doing what seemed right to him. And as we all probably have experience in, we can know that that always results in a very bad ending. I'm not going to go into the many ways in which our current age mirrors what we see here in the final chapters of Judges. British essayist Samuel Johnson said in 1783, in 1783, he said, "I have lived to see all things as bad as they can possibly be." And I think that that statement can be truly said by any person who has lived in any time, right? So the particular horrors of these chapters is not that these things were happening, because these things have almost always been happening, but it's that these things were happening among the people of God. And that's what made this such a very bad ending. When God's people do not strive to know and live by God's standards, we have every capacity to become just like the very worst of humanity. You all have probably picked up by now on the fact that the book of Judges has been littered with irony. Well, the greatest irony is this. Israel did have a king. They just simply refused to follow him. And believer, you and I have a king as well. So may we humble our hearts. May we remove the planks from our own eyes, and may we beg God to use the story of his people then to sanctify those of us who are following him now. Because he alone is the way to an end that does not disappoint.